You are listening to the Roberta Glass True Crime Report, putting the true back in true crime. From New York City, Roberta Glass is now on the record.
Welcome to the podcast. I hope you're having a good week. As we have made 200 episodes of my true crime report, I thought this would be a good time to look back at some of my most popular and controversial episodes. I'm recording this on the day of the 29th anniversary of the murder of Stevie Branch, Chris Byers, and Michael Moore, 3 8-year-old boys murdered in West Memphis, Arkansas in 1993. Their killers, 3 teenagers, Damien Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miss Kelly, became a cause célèbre after the release of the HBO documentary Paradise Lost. So popular was Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky's documentary that the pair made 2 sequels, and Amy Berg made a 4th. An estimated $10 to $20 million was spent by the child killers' advocates, getting them released. Celebrities Eddie Vedder, Johnny Depp, Natalie Maines, Marilyn Manson, and Peter Jackson, just to name a few, lent their public support and opened their wallets to get them released. In 2011, their legal team announced that they had found exonerating DNA that matched another stepfather. Prior to this, the convicted child killers and their advocates had publicly pointed the finger at stepfather John Mark Byers. Even Echols and Baldwin went on the records and said that they were 99% sure Byers was the real killer. In reality, the 2 pieces of evidence that they presented were very weak. They matched 1.5% of the population and 7% of the population. Just to give you a perspective, that's 4.5 million Americans, or 21 million Americans, matching each piece of evidence. And the results of the other pieces of evidence that they tested for DNA have never been released. With such weak evidence of their innocence, the West Memphis lawyers and their PR team devised what I would call a legal sleight of hand. So publicly, they put in all the legal paperwork to get a new trial, and it really looked like they were going to go get a new trial. But privately, they asked for an Alford plea, which is legally a guilty plea, but you can publicly still maintain your innocence. So you're saying that the prosecution had enough evidence to convict you, but at the same time, you're saying you're innocent. It's a little tricky. I was one of the people that was fooled by the Paradise Lost movies. And when they were released, I was excited. I thought that a wrong had finally been righted. And it was not until I heard Ed Opperman's podcast that I'd ever heard the other side of the argument presented. And that sent me on a long journey of researching. And when I finally finished researching, I wanted to talk about some of the buried evidence. And so this was one of my first podcasts, and it's also one of my most popular. Listening to it now, it makes me want to eat my iPad. It's so cringy. It's not sophisticated. I stammer a lot, but I hope I got my points across, and I hope I sent some other people on a journey of reading the transcripts, looking at the evidence, learning both sides, and coming to a conclusion of their own. Here it is.
What are the chances that 2 people would fail a polygraph and that those same 2 people would not have alibis and those same 2 people would confess? One of them, multiple times, one time with their lawyer present. Let's talk about Jesse Miss Kelly. I'm just dying to talk about Jesse Miss Kelly's confession. So let's talk about them. All right. Because I don't want to sit on this anymore, but let's talk about them. The guy confessed to Buddy Lucas. Then he confessed to the police. Then he confessed to his lawyer. Then he, okay, I'm at four right now. Then after he was convicted, he got in the police car and confessed to the police all the way to jail. After jail, when his lawyer was working on his appeal, and this is recorded, you can hear his lawyer begging him not to confess. And Jesse Miskelly says, I want something done about it. So if that is coercion the other way, the lawyer's telling him to shut up. And he's like, no, I want something done about it. And he gives another long, detailed confession. Then there's another time, also recorded, also on YouTube. If you look up Jesse Miskelly's confessions, not one, multiple. Now we're on, what, six? with his hand on the Bible. He also confessed to an ardent West Memphis 3 supporter who went under the name True Romance. Her name was Lindsay. And she was sending him a ton of money. And finally, he confessed to her. And she said something very interesting, which I always remember because it's something that I keep in mind as I'm researching true crime. She said that the guilty side never lied to me. And I think back to that, and other people and people who've heard my other podcasts will know that I got a letter early on in the Amanda Knox case at my job describing her case. She had just been arrested, and they talked about how she was vilified in the press because she went out and bought underwear. And she had just bought this 99 cents underwear, white underwear in the bin, and the press made it into something that it wasn't, that she went out and bought lingerie. Lo and behold, if that wasn't a lie, why would they lie about that? In fact, Amanda Knox went out and bought lingerie with her boyfriend. She's on film holding it up right after the murder, saying, you know, I can't wait to go home and have great sex. That's what the store owner said. I really don't care what she said. The point to me of that, or the sort of wake-up moment in my own life, was if you have a organization like the Friends for Amanda or the West Memphis 3 organization, and they are feeding you, or Bob Ruff, and they are feeding you information that is false, you have to wonder why. Or excluding information.
The Serial podcast created a sensation when it was released in October of 2014. Listeners were treated to a weekly installment of journalist Sarah Koenig's reinvestigation of the murder of Haman Lee. Lee was a popular high school student, a senior at Baltimore, Maryland's Woodlawn High School, when she was found strangled to death in Lincoln Park on February 9, 1999. Her ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, was arrested and then tried and convicted. Actually, tried twice. His first trial was declared a mistrial before he was convicted in a second trial on February 25, 2000. After Serial was released, the public and the press firmly aligned themselves with Haman Lee's killer, with the exception of Canadian true crime writer Anne Brocklehurst and The Intercept's Natasha Vargas Cooper and Ken Silverstein, and a few others, who received much backlash for presenting the public with the prosecution's side of the case, a narrative that the jury accepted. It wasn't until an anonymous person bought the transcripts to Syed's trial and posted them on Reddit did the public sentiment change. And that's really key, that a wrongful conviction campaign can only be successful with an ignorant and uninformed public. There were many things I found incredible about Serial. Firstly, that the public would have such sympathy for an obvious lowlife and liar as Adnan Syed. I just found that amazing. Secondly, the lack of sensitivity and sympathy for the victim, Haman Lee. She was completely obscured and overlooked in Serial, with little time devoted to her. Adnan Syed was painted as the real victim in the podcast, And that was created by omitting and dismissing most of the important evidence in the case, reducing the story to a kind of he said between Adnan Syed and his accomplice, Jay Wilds. Sarah Koenig rose to fame after Serial was released, receiving awards and accolades, including the 2015 Peabody Award. I wonder if Koenig thinks that re-victimizing Heyman Lee's family and friends was worth it. In one of my favorite episodes, I talked to Alexa, who was Adnan Syed's biggest supporter, before changing her mind and affirming that he was rightfully convicted. At the same time she was advocating for Syed's innocence, she was also donating to the Innocence Project. She says in this episode that the conspiracy mindset is key to understanding any wrongful conviction campaign, and that's been one of the most helpful insights to understanding this movement. It's not that the wrong guy got convicted in error. The killer is always a victim of a conspiracy. And I found that they usually attach the conspiracy to some social inequality like racism or sexism. Here's Alexa's interview. This is the episode, Nothing Left Undisclosed, My Life in the Free Adnan Syed Cult. Take a listen.
So they blow up the minutia and then they go to the conspiracy angle. Because once you believe that there's a conspiracy involved in it, then you can just go ahead and throw out any evidence, especially, you know, Jay and knowing where the car was, because they make you believe that these cops are just so horrible and corrupt that they're absolutely willing right. to lie about Jay telling them where the car was. Because, you know, I'm sure you heard about the tap, tap, tap. They're tapping on a piece of paper and telling him everything in Morse code or, you know, like,
are you kidding me? I know I haven't heard about the tap, 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 but,
Oh, you haven't?
No, I haven't. That's how they communicated what was going. That's right. I gotta listen more to undisclosed. So how did this all come apart? Like, how did this whole worldview crash for you?
It all crashed. Okay. So I was super into it for, I want to say it was over 2 years. I mean, it was definitely over 2 years where I was constantly donating to, his legal fund.
So you gave money to the legal fund, the page, and what? Bob Ruff's Patreon. You gave money to Bob Ruff's Patreon, the legal fund.
Yes.
Uh huh.
I helped build the shed.
Right.
Mainly though, I donated a lot on several occasions to Adnan's legal fund and to other innocent projects. But, so it was definitely over 2 years, and I would get on Reddit and I would just, you know, anytime someone would want to debate me and say anything about the evidence, I would say, evidence? Sorry that you know, live in a world where you think the police don't plant evidence and make up things, but I live in the real world.
Right, you're so naive.
Happen.
Right.
And, you know, so therefore you can just throw away all that evidence because none of it even matters because he didn't do it.
Right.
And I was very into that for a long time, and I don't know if it was just, you know, like I said, it was a couple of years, and then I got into other things, and I had more stuff going on, and I didn't really get on Reddit as much, and Undisclosed, you know, there were several seasons of that, and then Serial Dynasty turned into Truth and Justice, and there's several seasons of that, and I followed, and I listened, but I wasn't nearly as into it as I was with Adnan, and I just hadn't really dealt with it for a few months. I was, like,
you took a break.
Busy doing other things.
Right.
When I heard an episode, I had found this other podcast I really liked called Cold Case Murder Mysteries, and I heard a few episodes of it, and I really liked the guy. And then I saw that at some point in the past he had done an episode on Adnan. He had done, like, a two-part thing. And I thought the guy was, like, the smartest person ever. I loved the way he analyzed cases. So I was like, I can't wait to hear him just, you know, destroy the same case and go on about how innocent Adnan is. So I was, like, really excited to hear it, and I turned it on, and, like, within the first 30 seconds or a minute or so, he said, and Adnan is obviously guilty. And I was like, whoa, like, I didn't even want to hear it. Like, I actually turned it off mm-hmm. and decided I wasn't even going to listen to it because I was just horrified that this guy could possibly think Adnan was guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm never even going to listen to the show again. I didn't want to hear anything he said after that. But then a few days later, I was, you know, bored, and I was like, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get my some paper and a pen, and I'm going to write down. I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to write down all the things he gets wrong, because clearly this guy isn't listening to Undisclosed. He doesn't know about all this new evidence. So I'm going to write down all the stuff he misses, and I'm going to write him a strongly worded email and let him know, you know, what everything that he gets wrong.
Uh-huh.
So I turn it on, and I start listening, and he just, I think it was because I hadn't been involved in that world. I kind of stepped away from it. I wasn't on Reddit. I wasn't constantly listening to, you know, the echo chamber of innocence constantly. So I just heard the guy, the host, his name is Ryan.
Right.
I just heard his perspective of it, and he said from the very beginning that you don't need to know anything about the cell phone towers. You don't need to hear anything about Jay's stories. You don't need to know anything about Asia McClain. None of that even matters. All you need to know in order to know who committed this crime is listen to Adnan's own words and actions.
NXIVM was the first case that I reported from the courtroom, and it was the case that made me a trial-going junkie. I watched in awe and fascination from the early hearings all the way through Keith Raniere's trial. The six defendants were facing very serious charges, but you would never know it by their demeanor, which was both defiant and off-tone upbeat. I'll never forget locking eyes with NXIVM's second-in-command, the prefect. That was what NXIVM devotees called Nancy Salzman. In person, her sharp eyebrows and thousand-yard stare gave off an impression of a Star Trek spaceship commander. Claire Bronfman, the Seagram heiress, who funded the NXIVM defense team to the tune of $13.8 million, appeared in court, a slight, shy figure with dead eyes that made the hair on the back of your neck stand up. Claire rarely spoke in court. Both Claire Bronfman and actress Allison Mack looked so ill at those early hearings, their skin a translucent shade of light yellow and green I've never seen before or since. I was shocked when one by one each of the NXIVM defendants all pled guilty. Save the Vanguard, Keith Raniere. He went to trial. The courtroom was packed for Raniere's trial. The Vanguard, dressed in a very Lyle and Eric Menendez style of pastel sweaters, handed his legal team what seemed like an endless parade of post-it notes. Presenting each yellow square to his legal team as if it contained the answer to life's great mysteries, Keith Raniere was clearly in command of his defense team's strategy. His lawyer, Mark Agnifello, offered an opening and closing statement and a vigorous cross-examination. He never put on a defense. As I write this, Donald Trump Jr. has just retweeted Nikki Klein's tweet. One of the last of the NXIVM cult's true believers, Trump affirmed Klein's assertion that this trial was an example of prosecutorial overreach. I wonder what Donald Trump Jr. would have thought had he heard the testimony of Danny. Danny, whose entire family had moved to Clifton Park from Mexico to be near the cult leader, had had their entire family destroyed by NXIVM. Danny strutted up to the witness box like a model on the catwalk in high heels and tight knee-length skirt to give the most disturbing and heartbreaking testimony. Danny had made the mistake of having romantic feelings for another man. For punishment, she was locked in an empty room in her family's house. Every day she wrote letters to the Vanguard begging to be let out, but the answer always came back, no. She could hear the sound of her family living life without her. She began to both resent and enjoy the sounds of her family, as it was her only connection to the outside world, save Lauren Salzman, who delivered her meals. Her tooth began to painfully deteriorate in her mouth. Only after months of pain and pleads to see a dentist was she taken to get a root canal. The opportunity to leave her solitary confinement made going to the dentist the most pleasurable and happiest day of her confinement. Claire Bronfman's sentencing hearing was held during the pandemic, the first to be sentenced. No family member or friends came to support or to speak in Bronfman's defense. Only the cult loyalists appeared in the overflow room. The sentencing hearing seemed to sum up so much of my experience covering the NXIVM case, both the emotion and the incredible strangeness. Here's the clip. I'm returning to the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse this morning to watch Claire Bronfman's sentencing. I look forward to the methodical ritual of the security procedure, the metal detectors, the checking of phones. I've come to pack a bag, so I move through each point effortlessly. The quiet, the order, and feeling of safety has been a comfort, as I have watched high-priced defense lawyers try to win the court's favor with a rap better suited to a used car salesman than a lawyer. I've watched broken souls in various states of healing tell the court what Keith Raniere took from them, their money, their freedom, their self-worth, their sanity, and most sadly, their ability to trust another human being. Only twice did I witness the serene quiet, the military-like order of the court, disturbed. Both those moments were sparked by Claire Bronfman. The first was when the judge demanded the criminal defendant, Bronfman, speak to the court not through her lawyers, but for herself. She had to answer for why she had hid her recently hired legal representative, Michael Agnotti, from the court. Before she could answer, a bench hearing was requested and granted. White noise filled the courtroom briefly, then was turned off again, and as Claire Bronfman headed to the defendant's table, her knees buckled, she grabbed for a chair in front of her, and she performed a faint. By the time the EMTs arrived with their gurney, Bronfman's health seemed to have radically improved. I'll never forget Bronfman jumping on the gurney in the aisle of the courtroom, sitting straight up with her legs straight in front of her, patent leather tasseled loafers, the toes of them pointing skyward. It's a vision that's burned in my brain. The second time Claire Bronfman caused disorder and frenzy was with her plea deal, where she forfeited $6+ million in restitution and pled guilty to two puny counts, one of credit card fraud and one of harboring an illegal alien for unpaid labor and services. The journalist shot out of the courtroom afterwards. I followed and joined the circles of puzzled faces, frenzied notebook and pen holders. Can she just do that? Can she just pay for the sentence? Everyone asked. Claire Bronfman's money gave Keith Raniere the ability to buy the props he needed to make his coat look somewhat respectable. $1 or $2 million, depending on who's reporting, for a visit with the Dalai Lama, not to mention His Holiness's public endorsement of Raniere and his program. Claire's money also gave NXIVM the ability to sue their enemies into silence, submission, or just keep them in the court system long enough to be holding on to their existence by the thinnest of threads. Claire Bronfman's letter to the court before her sentencing is such an open admission of her narcissism, sadism, and entitlement that it boggles the mind. I have lost sleep wondering how her lawyer could okay her submission of this. She refused to disavow NXIVM or Keith Raniere, instead insisting it helped her and many other nameless, faceless people for the better, never saying how, never saying who they were, how they were helped. And if that is true, they certainly didn't appear in court. In fact, Keith Raniere's defense team didn't even bother putting on a defense. Instead, the jury heard from
woman after woman who had been manipulated, starved, branded, financially and sexually exploited by Ranieri with Bronfman's financial help. Without Bronfman's money, NXIVM was just a small-time cult, but with her money, its diabolical and dangerous nature hid under a slick veneer, the best veneer that money can buy. It wasn't quite respectability, it wasn't quite a good reputation, but it came close. Without NXIVM, Claire Bronfman was just another high school dropout with a billionaire trust fund. NXIVM gave her targets and tactics to use her money to annihilate others, and annihilation made her feel powerful. It's not just Bronfman's open admission in finding joy in others' suffering that makes me think she's evil. It's the experience of looking into her eyes as I passed her in the courthouse hallways. Her eyes are empty and black with no empathy.
I expected the government to shine at Ghislaine Maxwell's trial. Instead, I was treated to a young, overworked, demoralized prosecution team that just seemed to be praying that all their hard work and the weight of the evidence against Maxwell would pay off. Audrey Strauss, the Southern District of New York's experienced prosecutor, who was expected to try the case, had resigned just months before the trial, leaving the government's team seemingly with no senior leader. In contrast, Ghislaine Maxwell's $7 million defense team appeared polished, well-rested, and confident. Cameras are not allowed in federal trials in New York City, and what the public will never know is how close a case it was. The jury seemed absolutely enthralled with the few witnesses the defense presented, especially memory expert Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, who was fresh off her role as defense witness in the Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, and Robert Durst trials. In the Durst trial, she had been absolutely demolished over days in a lengthy and clever cross-examination by Assistant Deputy DA John Lewin. In the Maxwell trial, the government's cross-examination was reduced to what felt like no longer than 30 minutes. Held in the dead of a cold New York winter, with COVID restrictions making masks mandatory in the courthouse, this was not an easy trial to cover. Unless you had the money to hire a line sitter to arrive at the courthouse at midnight, public interest in the trial made getting into the courtroom an impossibility. Just getting into the courthouse took an hour on most days, just to get through the security check. In addition, Maxwell's charges of sex trafficking and conspiracy spanned the time period between 1994 and 2004. So not only was I among the majority of trial goers viewing the trial through one of the many overflow rooms, the witnesses themselves were testifying about events that happened to them sometimes decades ago. Gone was the emotional immediacy. The trial and my connection to it seemed to be symbolized by my position in the courthouse, remote and distant. Was I happy I went? Yes, but happy in the way one is when they accomplish a physically challenging and difficult task. Happy for the people I met, happy to say I covered it, and very happy it's over. And pleased so far that Maxwell has been unsuccessful in her bid to get a second trial.
So I was expecting Maxwell. We had all these reports from her family saying she's starving, she's being tortured in jail, she's in inhumane conditions, she's lost all this weight, she's losing her hair, she's not eating well. Lo and behold, if there is not Maxwell with thick, thick shoulder-length hair, looking healthy as a horse in court, in a white sweater, a white mask, obviously to try to get some kind of trustworthy
appearance for the jury. It was absolutely wild. And there is her lawyer with this kind of short gray hair. It looks kind of like almost, it's like that kind of gray hair that almost looks purple in a certain light, kind of gray in a certain light, very short. And she was doing her lipstick, and then she put her mask on over her lipstick. And she's a big woman. And she starts out her opening statement saying, hold on, let me get this exact quote, because it's so outrageous. She says, ever since Eve was accused of tempting Adam with the apple, women have been blamed for the bad behavior of men. Try to make Maxwell look like a martyr and trying to bring in some kind of feminist element. And when she referred to the victims, she used the word women. It took a lot of courage for Lynn Hartman to come on my podcast. Lynn Hartman was not only the biggest supporter of Teresa Halbach's killer, Stephen Avery, she was, for a short time, engaged to him. That was until the relationship went south, as all of woman beaters Avery's relationships go, with Avery threatening and harassing Lynn. Luckily for Hartman, this was all done from behind prison walls where she couldn't be physically hurt. As I was reporting on the Making a Murderer phenomenon, I was also attending and reporting on the early NXIVM hearings, and it was impossible for me not to see a parallel between Lynn Hartman and the NXIVM survivors. Hartman was seduced by Making a Murderer at a vulnerable time in her life, gained some happiness by being among like-minded people with a similar goal, only to have the group turn on her when she changed her mind and disavowed their cause. This interview caused more pushback from the pro-Avery, pro-Dassey, Making a Murderer crowd than any other. Why? My feeling is that it's pretty easy to call me, or a former prosecutor, tunnel-visioned, uninformed, and wrong. But it's a lot harder to discount a former supporter. You can't say that they are, their favorite word, biased. You can't say that they don't know the supporters' talking points. What do they have left? Well, they had the laughable claim that Lynn was a scorned woman, a gold digger. Because who doesn't want to get rich by marrying a convicted killer who someday just might get out of prison and have a civil suit against the state where she could gain some money? I mean, that's just every woman's dream. Which, coincidentally, the most surprising thing about this interview was what I see as the ultimate projection. Hartman revealed in this interview that the Making a Murderer franchise was big business. And she talked about how the producers and the filmmakers protected their asset at all cost. Listen to the clip.
I had everybody in the world calling me for an interview. And Dr. Phil was the one I picked.
Uh-huh. That's a really interesting interview because it's very contradictory, that interview. On one hand, you're saying... Yeah. I absolutely believe in his innocence, but then there's a moment mm-hmm. where Dr. Phil asks you mm-hmm. if, I can just hear you know what's coming, if you want to, Stephen Avery wants to live with you in a cabin in a woods alone, would
right.
you be comfortable?
Exactly.
And you say no.
Exactly.
Why did you say mm-hmm. no? And were you worried saying no? And why did you say that?
Okay. Well, for a lot of reasons. A lot of them I've already mentioned, which was that I had been going through turmoil for the last couple of days prior to that interview with all of the supporters, with Stephen Avery. I even had a call from Laura Ricciardi all about how she needed me to sign the Making a Murderer contract before I went on the show. So I was under a lot of pressure and a lot of stress from not only all of those people, but thousands of supporters. So my attitude changed drastically from one day to the next.
Interesting.
Because I was a wreck the second day, understandably. So
Former Calumet County, Wisconsin District Attorney Ken Kratz, who prosecuted Teresa Halbach's killer, Stephen Avery, and his teen accomplice, Brendan Dassey, in 2007, epitomizes why lawyers make such fantastic guests. A little bit like a wind-up toy, ask them a question and they just talk and talk and talk in complete grammatically correct sentences and paragraphs. Ken Kratz's prickly and cool temperament is paired with a razor-sharp intellect. He's one of the smartest people I've ever come across, which is why I interviewed Ken twice. Without Ken Kratz, the pushback on making a murderer Netflix's largely fictional account of the investigation and trial against Avery and Dassey would have become American myth. So outraged by this rewriting of history, Ken Kratz went on a one-man PR campaign for truth. And I'll never forget sitting in the NXIVM hearings and talking to one of the journalists. She was telling me about how many times Ken Kratz had contacted her to get another story, just another story about the truth out in her publication. And it worked. Now all that's left of the Free Avery and Dassey campaign is just a handful of conspiracy-minded, pro-criminal, true believers. No small feat indeed. But when I listen back on these interviews, I think about what a loss to victims and their families that Kratz is no longer practicing law. It's no coincidence that Kratz was cast as the villain at the same time money was pouring in from around the country to fund the campaigns of pro-criminal DAs like Kimberly Fox in Chicago and Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. Krasner, it was reported in 2021, that 3/4 of his campaign contributions came from out-of-state donors. And one of his biggest whale donors? Patty Quinlan, the wife of Netflix's CEO. May I remind you that Netflix brought us Making a Murderer? I hope you're paying attention.
They've tried. They've started with police officers. They didn't plant anything. And when Kathleen Zellner's own expert said that the vial wasn't tampered with, when Kathleen's expert said the vial wasn't used as the source of blood, that it wasn't planted, at least based upon this, did you hear the apologies after that, Roberta? Did you hear the filmmakers say, I know we told you guys that these cops planted this evidence, and we'd really like to correct the record now that we know that that didn't happen. I didn't see that. Maybe you heard from, let's say, Jerry Buting, who was willing on Making a Murderer to go on this docuseries and lie to 40 million people and say that there's this vial of blood in the clerk's office with a hole in it. And gee, Dean, I'll bet the cops went in there. That's nonsense. He knew by the time of trial that a nurse named Marlene Kranitz had put the hole in the vial of blood. She was ready to testify. He was so convinced that this tampering with the blood was no longer a viable defense that they didn't even bring it up in trial. So the fact that they abandoned this smoking gun, but they resurrect it for Making a Murderer, saying, aha, this is it. This is how we know that they planted evidence. And what they did was they identified Jim Link as the cop. They said he had this position, that he was the overseer of evidence, that he had gone into the clerk's office, that he had filled out this transmittal form, that he had taken this vial of blood, that he had sent it to Madison, which proved that he had been handling the blood. And then after it was back, he knew it was there and he could go in and he could take it. Well, he filled out transmittal form, as I'm sure you know now, and hopefully your listeners know by now, had nothing to do with the blood, had nothing to do with the vial of blood in the clerk's office. That transmittal form was for fingernail clippings and hair that was sent. No blood. The blood was never touched. In fact, Jim Link testified in the trial and explained all of that and said, I didn't even fill out that form. I never touched that box. I never went into the clerk. I didn't even know the existence of this vial of blood until after the Avery case had already been charged. So when they know that's the fact, I'm talking about Jerry Buting now, if you're following along at home. Jerry Buting, where's the apology? You said that Jim Link was a crook. You said he was a criminal. You said he planted evidence and you showed us the vial of blood. Where's the apology? Where's the retraction? And from a Netflix standpoint, Netflix knew that this was all a lie right after Making a Murderer came out, right? I mean, Netflix heard from me and others that they spliced testimony. They made it look like things happened that never happened in real life, that they had flat out come out and misrepresented things. Yet Netflix allows it today to keep being shown. So the defamation against Andy Colburn and Jim Link and myself happens every day. Why haven't they fixed it? You know, I watched this Game of Thrones show on HBO, and I remember the last program, there was this big uproar about a Starbucks cup. By the next time it was shown, Roberta, HBO had fixed it. They removed this cup from their movie. Well, why in the hell has it taken Netflix 4 years to fix it? Fix it, Netflix. You know it's a lie. You know it's not a documentary. You at least know now where everybody suggests this splice occurred, or they made up this answer. I show you both in my book and in several videos of where this happened. So ask them why. Ask them why they haven't fixed it. Ask Jerry why he hasn't apologized, or Dean, or any of them, when they went out of their way to cast these people as villains, when they took their reputations from them, continued to smear them over and over and over, and even after the death threats, and even after they were forced to retire, and even after they were shunned from their communities, nothing. Nothing by way of any kind of a remedy or any kind of consequence for their lying. They simply move on to Making a Murderer 2 and start the lies all over. Somebody's got to ask a question, Roberta. The documentary film industry, or some place, they have to ask Laura Riccardi, why did you splice this in and make it look like it happened when it never did? Why did you lie to 40 million people? Her answer so far has been, well, it was an entertainment show. I never said it was true. Well, are you kidding me? If that's going to be your answer, if your answer is, yeah, we made stuff up, but we never said it was true, well, you got some splaining to do, lady. You got some splaining to do to 40 million people and two cops and one prosecutor whose careers you ended. That's my point on all this. Well, that's too much, but they sit by like they can't do anything to fix it. Fix it! Take those lying things out of your show. It's still a good show, even without all the deception. And so you show it that way. Don't continue to perpetuate this defamation against the people that you've cast as villains.
This is sort of you look at like the West Memphis 3 movie. I don't know how familiar you are with them, but one documentary points the finger at one grieving stepfather. Then the next one that comes out after that one points the finger at another grieving stepfather. And none of the child murderer supporters say anything. Like, what happened to the other guy in the case of Teresa Halbach's murder? They accused her ex-boyfriend of committing the murder. Right. And then just sort of they have amnesia and it's just not important anymore. It's what I'm asking, I guess, is do you feel like we're reaching an age where sort of fantasy and reality are becoming true crime entertainment mixed so that these people aren't real people or it doesn't matter or it's just satisfies?
You know, I'm really concerned about our country because, you know, I watch the political arena as well as, you know, as well as things in the legal field. And it seems like the truth doesn't matter anymore. It seems like people are willing on either side to present their narrative. Confirmation bias is that everybody just talks to themselves, right? And so there's no opportunity for conversation anymore. If I try to bring up a point, they don't just want to discuss they want to silence me, Roberta. They want to trash me. They want to call me everything but a Packer fan. And so it's my position that this has gotten really scary. This has gotten to the point where if the truth doesn't matter anymore, and if you're willing to ruin the reputations of police officers, prosecutors, and good people just doing their job, and you're supporting this, and you're on that side being an advocate for this kind of behavior or this kind of treatment of our law enforcement or our prosecutorial community, we're in trouble, Roberta. This is picking the wrong side of history on these cases to embed yourself or to embrace misogynistic, pathological killers rather than a poor 25-year-old photographer, a young woman who had no connection, no reason. She should have been targeted and killed, but she was. And where's the sympathy for her? Where's all of the outcry for women, violence against women and domestic abuse? So I tend to keep saying the same thing over and over, but I don't think we can say it enough, Roberta, that people better start reintroducing themselves to their common sense. You know what I mean? We shouldn't just suspend common sense when we want to advocate for a position or we want to fight for a position. The ends don't justify the means. The means are really, really important. The process by which we convict people is really important. The fairness by which prosecutors give discovery and provide, you know, all the information that I did in this case, yet to attack me of all of the thousands of reports and video and audio and things that I gave the defense attorney because of some CD that ended up in some investigator's briefcase, Zellner claiming this is the worst Brady violation she's ever seen. By the way, on a piece of evidence that Dean Strang, the defense attorney, stipulated that he said there's nothing of evidentiary value here. Hey, guess what, Roberta? Dean Strang didn't want to go into that computer. There was a reason that Dean's client, Stephen Avery, told Dean, as we know, he's told many people on phone calls that we've heard about, that if they ever get Barb's computer, there's going to be trouble. There's stuff on that computer that are going to be, you know, very damaging. Well, what did he tell his lawyer? What did Stephen Avery tell his lawyer was the importance, necessity that Dean Strang go try to seize this computer from Barb before the cops come and take it? You know, there's a phone call between Stephen Avery and his sister Barb when Dean Strang is there. He's there the day the computer was seized. And Barb says, your lawyer's here. He was here to get the computer. Well, what the hell is that about? Hey, Dean, what did your client tell you? Why did your client not want that in the hands of the cops? You ever ask that question? You ever wonder why Barb erased files or deleted files before the cops came and got the computer? It wasn't to protect her son.
I was totally seduced by Amanda Knox's million-dollar public relations campaign years before I ever had a podcast. I received a letter when I was working for Oprah shortly after Amanda Knox got arrested, and this was a letter from, I believe, the Friends of Amanda, and it painted an absolutely compelling picture of a young woman in Italy abroad, railroaded by a corrupt prosecutor. What I related to most was just a tiny detail in the letter. The letter's author maintained that the press had scorched Knox for buying lingerie with her boyfriend after the murder. What the press didn't take into account was that Knox had been exiled from her Italian villa, the crime scene, with no access to clothes, with no underwear. What was Knox to do but set off to buy some cheap white cotton underwear? And this had been misreported as insensitively buying lingerie. This, as with most of Amanda Knox's PR talking points, turned out to be a total lie, as the lingerie store's camera footage would be presented of Amanda Knox buying lingerie with her boyfriend and co-defendant, Raffaele Sollecito, his hands on her hips, and her reportedly saying, I can't wait to try this on and have great sex later. That may not be a word-for-word quote, but that gives you the gist. What's amazing to me is how little the people that push her innocence know about her case. Not one court that has looked at all the evidence in this case has come to the conclusion that Rudy Guidet did this alone. And yet, that is what we hear about 90% of the time, or 95% of the time in the American press. And that's including the court that overturned Knox's conviction. And speaking of Knox's overturned conviction, it's troubling at best. The court's conclusion, one of its many conclusions, was that Knox was at the scene of the crime and washed Meredith Kircher's blood off of her hands. I was really delighted to go over all the evidence that the American press buried in this episode with podcaster Tuesday Money. She's incredibly smart, knows a lot about this case and is really fun to make a podcast with. Take a listen.
The problem with this case is that it only works if you understand it at sort of a, I mean, you only, it only works for Amanda Knox's defense, I mean, if you only, if you accept it, everything on the surface level, right? And you don't really put together the big picture or put in all the evidence. Maybe well, like, she could have gotten hit, yeah, like, okay. But how many people really falsely accuse a person of murder and then let him sit in prison for 2 weeks? Someone you know. And he and she ruined his life, by the way, Patrick Lumumba. I mean, oh, he yeah. lost his business. I mean, it really was devastating to his life. For what reason? To try to save herself?
And that's just it. She's never really provided a good reason. But this case, like everything else, I mean, it begins to make sense when you take everything into consideration. What the defense likes to do, which is what every defense does, is they like to isolate different things and act as though they occurred in a vacuum. And anyone can look at different little pieces and say, well, that's, you know, to be expected, or, oh, well, that's not that big of a deal. But when you combine everything and you put everything together and you take account the person that saw her the next morning going into the aisle of the cleaning supplies, and you take all of this stuff into consideration, you put it all together, it points to a logical conclusion that they were definitely involved. And that's exactly what the police believed. But if you try and isolate everything and you try to poke holes and stuff, then it becomes easier to say, well, you know, make excuses and blame everybody. But like you pointed out with the DNA, it's just, you can't say one set of DNA is valid and then magically say that the other two involved, well, that's just contaminated. The police don't know Amanda. They have no reason to frame her or pin it on her. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense.
I've done more episodes with William Ramsey of the William Ramsey Investigates podcast than any other person. He interviewed me first on his podcast when this podcast just started, and I've always been very grateful for that. And we've done, I believe, over 30 episodes together at this recording. And if there's any secret to why this collaboration works so well, I think that we really like each other and our strengths complement each other, and he can always put me in a good mood. Although this episode, it was challenging. Let's go back a little bit. I was really disappointed when I heard that the biggest podcast in the country, Joe Rogan's podcast, was having on major players of the wrongful conviction movement and pushing what I consider this innocence fraud narrative. I mean, he's had on paroled child killer Damien Echols, BFF Duncan Trussell, as well as Jason Flom. So it wasn't surprising that Joe Rogan would have on the dame of the movement, the queen of convicted and ultimately acquitted killers, Amanda Knox. So when William Ramsey emailed me and asked me to listen to 3 hours of Joe Rogan's fawning love fest of an interview with Amanda Knox, I only said yes. Well, because did I mention that I really love William Ramsey? So this interview starts with Joe Rogan introducing Amanda Knox as a wrongfully convicted person. And I wondered how he would have introduced O.J. Simpson or Casey Anthony if he had them on. And it goes downhill from there. And that's pretty much what I expected. And I don't know why I expected more from the guy who touted former pimp Bob Lazar as the real deal in the UFO field. But what I didn't expect was how Joe Rogan's mind kept creeping the conversation to murder. Take a listen.
What other notes do you have?
Okay, so what, he also starts talking about horrible things in the world. We played a little bit of that. He starts talking about animals eating their own young. Which animals eat their own young? You remember that part? He talks about dolphins and bears eating their own young. This is what's going on in his head. All sorts of types of murder situations, the worst kinds of injustices in nature. I mean, a psychiatrist could have a field day with this interview, I thought.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
So I was like, why is he talking about animals eating eating their own young? And then he starts talking about, well, kids see horrible things today. And he starts out with pornography on their cell phones. And then he goes to murder. And then he quickly corrects himself and says car crashes. But murder is constantly on in his brain. The fact that he may be sitting
across from a murderer.
Across from a murderer, yeah.
He must have a little hint that something's amiss, is my guess.
I'm like, Joe Rogan, your subconscious is screaming.
Yeah, he might. And the weird smiling that you made the whole time might have freaked him out. Like, if I was sitting across somebody who smiled off-tone smiles and stuff, I'd be like, oh, uh-oh. I don't know what's going to happen, but I certainly hope that he doesn't get any other sketchy people like her. But she kept saying, of course, it was Rudy Gaudet. So she said that at 1:14. She also said, is my life over because somebody doesn't admit they were wrong? So that's another one. And then she threw the old West Memphis 3 special in there. The DNA was never tested, right? So that's even
That's another totally falsehood, too. There was no sperm found of Rudy Gaudet anywhere that wasn't tested. That's totally false. I mean, she throws in all the same falsehoods.
The case of 3-year-old Madeline McCann, who disappeared from her family's holiday apartment in Praia da Luz, Portugal on May 3rd, 2007, is the only case I have talked about on my podcast that hasn't been tried. No one has been convicted. However, the PJ Files, the Portugal police investigation of the case, exists on the internet for anyone who is interested in reading it. And I was really pleased to talk with both Tom of the 10 p.m. Praia da Luz Facebook group and Isabel McFadden, who has researched this case diligently and who has devoted some part of every day of the past 15 years to getting the truth out. That's quite an accomplishment. And I've been pleasantly surprised to see the public's interest in this case has not diminished. And it's also been exciting to see that the press has moved from only reporting the McCann's PR talking points to presenting a fuller and more skeptical view of the case. And I hope we are finally coming to getting a little closer to getting justice for Madeline.
They created a timeline on a little piece of Madeline's book, which is another amazing thing, how they ripped the child's book. She's missing, and they rip her book to write her timeline. So they wrote two timelines, and basically their version of the story was that they were getting up throughout the dinner, and they were checking on the children every 15 minutes. But even when you look at this timeline they created, that itself is a lie, because it wasn't every 15 minutes. It was, some of it was every half an hour, you know, so the whole, everything is very interesting. Also, another interesting thing about these checks was that in some of their statements, they said that they never checked on each other's children the nights before. All those other nights, nobody checked on each other's children. Everybody checked their own. But for some reason that night, they were checking each other's children. Now, take it into consideration.
One of the podcasts that I'm proudest of is my podcast with Alexa. Remember Alexa from the Adnan Syed podcast on Marty Tankliff, whose 1990 conviction of the murder of his adopted parents, Arlene and Seymour Tankliff, was vacated in 2007. Tankliff hired the same public relations manager as the West Memphis 3, Lonnie Suri, with similar results. Absolutely love letter press, the same 2020 specials, and Tankliff is one of the few released convicts to become a lawyer, and he's now the darling of the movement that he boasts fosters and pushes, meaning he teaches law and he uses his class to reinvestigate and advocate for convicted people that he considers are wrongly convicted. The biggest challenge with this episode was finding the court documents, and it took us about 2 years to gather and find and read all the court documents in this case. And our familiarity with the original trial was reduced to pieces of that original trial that were included in Tankliff's appeal. So we were at a disadvantage to present the prosecution side of the case. When Tankliff became one of the handful of lawyers to represent convicted sex trafficker NXIVM cult leader Keith Raniere's appeal, I thought it would be a good time to talk about Tankliff's case. And I'm really proud of this episode. And it was really gratifying to hear from folks after the podcast release, folks who had sat through Tankliff's original trial. One of them even said it was the most accurate piece of media ever created on Marty Tankliff's case. However, Tankliff's civil lawyer, Bruce Barquette, listened to the episode and had a lot of insults for me on Twitter. I invited him on the podcast to talk about the case with one rule that it be a civil discussion of the episodes. But by his tweets, the sound of his tweets, he seemed much more interested in disparaging me and this episode than discussing all the evidence for his client's innocence. And as I record this, Marty Tankliff has been the only person tried and convicted for the murder of Arlene and Seymour Tankliff. Take a listen.
They've done a great job rewriting history, when at the time, everyone seemed to know he was guilty, even the media. He was portrayed as, you know, a spoiled teenager who killed his parents for their money.
Yeah. When he got convicted, it was on the cover of the New York Post with him making, I don't know if he was crying or just making a face when the jury's verdict came down. Sort of closing his eyes and making a kind of squinty face. But what you mostly read is that Jerry Sturman, because he did this wild thing after the murders, which was he faked his own disappearance and left for California.
And that's the greatest thing that's ever happened to Marty Tankliff, because he's so unlikable. Every single piece of evidence seems to point to only him doing it. But fortunately for him, his dad has a shifty business partner that disappeared right after the crime.
Right after the crime.
And it's so convenient because supporters, they love to point at this guy because he disappeared. He faked his own disappearance right after. And thank God for Marty Tankliff this happened. Otherwise, he'd have nothing to point to at all.
And it's interesting that that was the guy from moment one. So much so that the detective thought that Marty Tankliff's lawyer had paid Jerry Sturman to take a hike.
Yeah.
But Jerry Sturman did come back for the trial and did testify.
Yeah, and he denied that he was paid or whatever, but who knows? And yeah, he was on the stand. Whenever they try to claim Marty Tankliff or his supporters that it was this huge suspect that they never looked into. No, the cops did immediately. They all knew he disappeared, obviously, and they went and found him and were like, what's going on? And they thoroughly investigated him. He was thoroughly questioned. He was on the stand for days and days, questioned by Marty Tankliff's million-dollar defense attorneys.
Yeah, Robert Gottlieb.
They know for sure he didn't do it. Or the jury that heard everything he said was sure it wasn't him and was sure it was Marty. Every appeals court that he ever went to ever was still sure it was him and upheld his conviction. Until this very last one.
Mm-hmm. And you could see him while Marty Tankliff was in prison. He was, I mean, just throwing everything at the wall to see if it sticked. You know, Brady violations, confession should have been thrown out and turned down multiple times. But while he's in prison, this innocence campaign, he's got a PR agent and the press really starts shifting on this. And you'll start to see the headlines change. Jerry Sturman possibly did it, suspect. And when he got out, the other thing that Marty Tankliff did was he hired a private investigator to pull up all these alternative suspects that were supposedly hired by Jerry Sturman to do this. But some inconvenient facts is that Marty Tankliff admitted that he was a light sleeper in his questioning. So that doesn't make sense why he wouldn't hear why he slept through this hit on his parents.
Jerry Sterman would still have to pay Marty Tankleff and his sister back the money he owed his father.
Yeah, as if the murdering the parents would absolve the debt. No, that would make the debt be called in right away so that the estate could be settled.
And not too many professionals get hired to do murders in this sort of, do such a poor job.
And why would they overkill the mother so much? I mean, that's like a passionate, hateful overkill.
But Tankleff was also very talkative to his cellmates during this time and made some interesting admissions about the case. Can you talk about that?
There's a few times that he made little comments here. It says, shortly after Tankleff was convicted and remanded on June 28th, 1990, according to Martino's notes, Tankleff told me that he's in a better position now than before trial. He knows that his confession is going out the window by the appellate division. He knows that Collins has said that he was not going to trial if he lost the suppression hearing. There will be nothing to prove I did it, he said. He knows everything the DA has and can correct his defense accordingly. There's no physical evidence. The stupid detectives never looked inside of any gas tanks at all. That's where he put gloves in gas because he knew that gas eats up rubber gloves very nicely. The second time he repeated it to me about the gloves, he said they were in a gas can. Because of his confession, the detectives never looked in his garage. He told me that because of his family, he will get a new trial just like Klaus Van Bulo with the same pieces of key evidence withheld from the jury upon retrial. He said he has family and attorneys totally sandbagged into thinking he was victimized by hard-nosed detectives playing nice guy, bad guy. He only has to go into his little boy bag. He smiled. He feels bad about his father, but not about his mother because she was a real bitch. She watched everything he effing did. She did not even want him to get laid. When he hits the streets and collects his money, he's going to get away from his family because they were all too clingy for him. He wants to go on to the life that he deserves. Fun, son, and women. He said that the judge was a jerk for not letting in the SIC report into evidence, but it will go into his appeal. He wished he knew the ropes because then he would never have went for the effing drunk cop lying to him. He never applied any pressure to speak of to his father's wounds at all.
The push to free Texas death row inmate Darlie Routier never dies. It's fueled partly by anti-death penalty advocates and partly fueled by Darlie Routier's true believers who feel that she just couldn't have done it. And I was delighted to speak with a former true believer, Ryan Kester. Ryan Kester is a native of Texas, and he had devoted his teen years to researching the case, even setting out on recreating some of the most damning evidence in the case, only to have a change of heart and become an advocate for her guilt. And for those of you true crimesters who are a little younger or have just maybe living under a rock, Darlie Routier was a married mother of three children, 6-year-old Devin, 5-year-old Damon, and 7-month-year-old Drake, and she was living in Rowlett, Texas, when she claimed an unknown intruder came in and stabbed her two oldest children to death. Devin and Damon's injuries proved fatal, but Darlie was left injured and conscious. Darlie's wild 911 call and the story she told the police was totally inconsistent with the evidence, and it is no surprise that she was convicted of the murder of her son Damon in 1996, and that conviction was enough to send her to death row. She was never convicted for her son Devin's murder, although she is thought to be the one responsible. Ryan Kester was really knowledgeable about this case and really a joy to speak with. So knowledgeable that we had to do some of this interview in a second interview so he could squeeze in some important facts that he was disappointed we had left out the first time around. I remember getting very spooked at the end of this interview where Ryan talks about his correspondence with Darlie Routier and he hints to a disturbing part of Routier that the public doesn't see, and I got the feeling he was restraining himself from divulging something really ugly and intimate
and maybe ultimately embarrassing to him about his relationship with Darlie Routier and what he had learned. And he just says quietly, "Darlie Routier is dangerous." But what I understood in those words was something much deeper. I thought that what he was trying to say was that Darlie was a psychopath and that her poisonous thumbprints had left their mark on his psyche and soul. Be careful.
They would be having the biggest party, that they wouldn't want us to be sad. They're so happy up in heaven. To me, when I hear that, I hear her thinking that I'm giving them eternal happiness in heaven, too. I'm relieving them from the stress of this terrible world. Do you see that?
I think that that's how Darlie imagined it coming out. Like, unintentionally, she was justifying that for herself.
Right, exactly.
I don't think that it was...
Oh, no, not a motivation. I just... If you're suicidal and you see suicide and death as the ultimate happiness for yourself and your children, it does certainly take out a little bit of the morality out of it, right?
Oh, I agree. I don't believe that Darlie was actually suicidal. I think that she did it solely for attention.
Mm.
Not necessarily like that it was a calculated move. A lot of people will threaten suicide because it's a cry for help. And that's a better way of putting it. I believe that she did it because it was a cry for help. That she had realized that her life was getting to the point of, it was so overwhelming for her. And I don't blame her for that. And then she had this cry for help, and Darren dismisses it as the baby blues. And I think that that was another trigger for her, that nothing had changed after that. And people, I'm so sorry to keep on talking, but people also love to throw out things like, oh, well, it's all circumstantial. Circumstantial evidence is literally anything apart from eyewitness testimony. People often don't understand that. DNA, forensics, that's all circumstantial evidence. Direct testimony means eyewitnesses. And quite frankly, eyewitnesses are not as reliable as forensics. Wrongful convictions, do they happen? Absolutely. But not as much as people would have you believe. And not everything is a conspiracy.
So what happens when you're 12 years old, you start on this journey looking into this case? And you devote all this time and energy, and I guess you have of one mindset, and all of a sudden...
Everything comes crashing down?
Yeah, you realize a little bit of your identity has been kind of, I guess, you're wrong. You have to admit you're wrong. I mean, what is that experience like?
It was very hard. I was talking to... So I run the Rockwall True Crime Club, and the admins are so amazing. Like, some of them... I have a lot of friends my own age, but sometimes I need the advice of people who are a little bit more mature and may have gone through something like this. So I talked to my parents about it, and I was, you know, devastated talking to them about it because they've supported me. I mean, they've donated. They've funded over, I mean, $15,000 of my investigation into this case. So it was, at first, very, very upsetting. I went to the boy's grave because I hadn't visited in a while. And I needed to clear my head a little while, and I left flowers for them and cleaned it up a little bit, and then kind of left because I knew that that would be a good opportunity to level myself, because it is such an emotionally charged case. It's impossible not to get emotionally involved in certain cases. And when you are getting so close with the family and so close with people who are so passionate about this, you get so emotionally attached. Like you said, it becomes part of your identity. So that day was just awful for me personally. And then the next day I woke up and I just kind of said, you know, I need to think about this logically. And the hardest part for me was not admitting I was wrong, but I felt like I was letting people down. I felt like I had inspired so many people to look into this case. And I felt like I had so many people advocate for her. And at the end of the day, I felt like people would think that I was tricking them into advocating for a baby killer. Because if they shared my change of heart, then that's how I felt. I felt like I was advocating for a baby killer, the worst kind of person ever. And that was difficult for me. It was hard.
I've talked to a few people who've had similar Adnan Syed supporter, Lynn Hartman, who was engaged to Stephen Avery. I'm very interested in the story because it really, I don't know why it took me so long to figure out, because this is my story too, you know what I mean? This is also my story. I used to believe all this stuff. I used to watch documentaries and believe all on a superficial level.
Yes. And that was such a hard thing for me to comprehend also, is that I didn't just fall for a documentary. I looked through countless records. I have a 250 gigabyte folder on my computer devoted to this case. All of that I had already seen. And it was like, oh my God, like how could I be so blind to stuff that was right in front of me? I wasn't tricked by someone else. I was tricked by myself, you know, and I was tricked by Darlie.
Wow.
That was hard for me because I was like, you know, I don't fall for Stephen Avery because I've seen the actual stuff. I'm not worried about making a murderer. In this case, I had seen the actual stuff and I still fell for her. I fell for her manipulation. And this is not going to be the right way of saying it. And I hope that you don't take this out of context. But whenever you start to support Darlie, you fall in love with the idea of Darlie. She is a victim. She is everything that is wrong with the justice system, you know? And you don't fall in love with the person of Darlie, as some people do. I never really viewed her as anything other than the center of my case. But I always considered the boys to be a more realistic motive to fight for truth for them. And you fall in love with the idea of Darlie being innocent. That's a better way of putting it. You fall in love with the idea of Darlie being innocent, and love is blind. And you want to believe her, and you want to accept everything that her supporters say as fact, because it's easy to buy into. They're charismatic. She's charismatic. That's how she succeeded in convincing so many people.
If this weren't a death penalty case,
yes,
would this still be such a famous case?
No, it would not be.
Is that part of the appeal, that she's on death row, that she's going to be sent to death for a crime that she didn't commit?
Yes, I think that that is part of the appeal. And I think for some people, it's so against what people are taught to believe in our, forgive me for going pretty liberal, but patriarchal society, that it's very contradictory to the idea that women are simply not going to do something like this. And that if they did it, they don't deserve to die. That doesn't sit right with a lot of people. A lot of her supporters simply don't want to believe that a mother would kill their children. And I think that it's just not the case. I mean, there are so many women commit capital murder, not at an equal rate to men, but at a proportionate rate. And I think that the idea of a woman being on death row for a crime she didn't commit is just very exciting to people. One real quick tidbit, I'm so sorry, that I would love to point out. On Darlie's initial appeal, she never challenged the sufficiency of the evidence. She solely challenged procedural errors. And I think that that is very, very revealing. If I were truly innocent, I would make my attorney put in that the evidence is insufficient to support a verdict of guilty.
Okay, I have one more question. I'm so sorry, Ryan, because you're the first person who was a supporter I've interviewed or talked to that truly looked at all the evidence, read the court records, you know.
Anybody who's still a supporter and has gone over them thoroughly with an unbiased point of view is fooling themselves or is lying because they want to manipulate people. Whether that's malicious or if it's just kind of a social experiment unintentionally and see what all they can come up with, you'll see that a lot in the supporter groups. People that will just fight and fight and fight for the purpose of fighting for her and ignore crucial evidence that doesn't go to their cause or just try to find a way to excuse it.
So your advice is to read the court records, look at the evidence in an unemotional way.
Yes.
That is your advice to someone before becoming a supporter of anyone or a non-supporter, would you say?
I agree with both. I definitely think that if you are reviewing a record after the fact and you are trying to come up with a particular solution, that it will be tainted. I don't think that starting off with an innocent perspective or a guilty perspective is necessarily harmful. I would recommend going in as unbiased as possible and always giving the presumption of innocence, because that's what a jury has to do. And I always try to try a case in my mind from a jury's perspective. And in terms of Darlie, read the trial transcripts. It is a lot. But if you really don't want to, then read the defendant's and the state's appellate briefs, not the habeas petition, the appellate briefs. Because the habeas petition is filled with so much misinformation on her side, but the state's appellate brief really, really underscores some of the evidence against her.
You've made some terrific arguments here, and I've just really enjoyed talking to you. Is there anything we missed?
Oh, there was one thing I wanted to say earlier, but it had slipped my mind. One of the dangers of this case is that Darlie doesn't need a documentary. She doesn't need a film crew. She doesn't need anybody but herself to fool you. And that's a very dangerous thing. I used to think that it was a good thing to have emotion when looking at a case. And when you're factoring in the victim, it absolutely is. But whenever you are looking at a case where somebody's already been convicted, you have to take what the defendant says with a grain of salt. It is a tough thing to do because if they're proclaiming their innocence, you want to believe them. But she is a dangerous person. She's a scary person. She can fool you and she can manipulate you and she can convince you that what she says is the God's truth. She and her supporters want to portray her as very naive, but she is not. That was illustrated at trial. That's illustrated in every lie she's ever told. She is a convincing person. She is a narcissist and she is dangerous.
I was really pleased to be a part of a team of people fighting the campaign to free Oklahoma death row inmate and Paul Howe's killer, Julius Jones. Jones was the subject, actually one half of the subject of ABC's two-part documentary, The Last Defense, the other half being, coincidentally, Darlie Routier. The Last Defense was produced by a host of people, including Hollywood actress Viola Davis and two Innocence Project lawyers, Aida Lessingring and Vanessa Potkin. As disturbed as I was at mainstream media figures like Kim Kardashian and James Corden using their platform to sing the convicted killer's innocence, I was equally disgusted that ABC facilitated two Innocence Project lawyers to produce and profit off of their own propaganda. I was delighted to get the opportunity to talk to Julius Jones's original defense attorney, David McKenzie, who had been disparaged in The Last Defense. He's the only guest I've ever had who insisted on doing his interview in person when he was in New York City from Oklahoma on business, and it added another level of nerves and pressure to this interview, in addition to not knowing what the etiquette was to dragging a bunch of audio equipment to a stranger's room. I didn't know if David McKenzie was more upset that his reputation had been disparaged by this documentary and by Jones's campaign, or if he was more upset that the truth of Jones's case had been totally rewritten. I came to find that it was both, with the latter being more upsetting to McKenzie. And I think he says in this interview, you can't lie, cheat, or steal. And so what he's talking about is innocence fraud and being disturbed by these lawyers participating in innocence fraud. This was an interview that pushed me out of my comfort zone totally. And he's an interesting guy, David McKenzie, very funny and irreverent, but carrying around intense sorrow that was difficult to shake off after the interview's end, but surprisingly honest for a defense attorney.
You've asked me some questions that every lawyer in Oklahoma now are going, what the fuck is up with the pardon and parole board here? Clemency means mercy. Mm-hmm. So to relitigate guilt or innocence is clearly not what their task is. It is should have been that Julius is a good kid. He very well respected member of the Blood Gang and is a leader in the Blood Gang. For that, he should receive mercy. That was joking, though.
Right. I mean, do you think if he had reached over and strangled his lawyer next to them, that he would have given him clemency?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's insane. And it makes us look bad as a state, our legal system. And it's not great, but goddamn, it's not as bad as what the people of the United States saw in this pardon and parole hearing.
They're talking about injustice, and they're just creating. This is a way to create injustice. There's no checks and balances here. They just want to, on these media campaigns, there are no rules. There's no punishment for lying to a documentary crew or the media. They want to sort of take apart our justice system at the same time creating a totally new injustice system. It's very disturbing.
It's disturbing, but I think if you come to the conclusion that I've come to, and it's this is an abolitionist movement with regard to Julius Jones, because what his lead supporter told me was, yes, he did it, but we need a martyr. So, meaning, kill him so that we can have somebody that we said was was wrongfully executed. But what they didn't anticipate is that all the pushback from David Prater and Mike Hunter and John O'Connor and all these people, because the Howe family kind of, you know, backed off. They didn't really do anything. So we have millions and millions of dollars pumped into a PR campaign that has been incredibly effective. And I, you know, I will tell you that when I met with Amanda Bass and at one point talked to Mr. Bache, I said, you know, get me off the fucking hook here. I don't want somebody to die on their on my watch. And they're about to do it. And so they maybe have kind of done what I asked them to do. I just didn't ask them to lie, cheat, and steal.
You said some really interesting things on the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. You said, I expect lawyers to act a certain level of morals. I'm using my words, not yours. Honesty and morals, right? And here comes these. What were your interactions with them like?
I met with Amanda Bass and the investigator a couple of times, and I don't remember the investigator's name, but she's on the last defense. They came to my office and we talked about things. I was kind of nonplussed by them. I mean, you know, I didn't have a bad feeling about them, didn't necessarily have a good feeling about them. I just remember begging them, please get me off the fucking hook here. I met Dale Bache. I was in the building that I office in Oklahoma City. There's a restaurant down there, and I was down there at lunch one day, and somebody tapped on my shoulder, and it was Dale. And we chatted for a little bit. I said, you know, pass. This was after the last defense came out. And I wasn't pleased with it, but I didn't know it was going to go to this extent that it's gone to now. You know, pass on my best to Amanda Bass and good luck, guys. And she sent me he texted that to her, and she sent me an email immediately. So
were you surprised to hear your interview played at the clemency hearing?
A little bit, yeah. You have a duty of keeping confidences of clients, but when those clients attack you, you have the ability to defend yourself. And I think the one thing they played was with regard to Julius not testifying. And that whole line of, I mean, it's just fucking horse shit. I mean, it's a lie. It couldn't be more untruthful.
My interview with Devin Tracy, a.k.a. Atheism is Unstoppable, is one of my most controversial and talked about interviews for sure. Well, most things that surround Devin Tracy are swirled in controversy. Kicked off of YouTube in June of 2020, when I spoke to Devin in the early spring of 2021, he was turning out excellent multi-part episodes on the Julius Jones and Purvis Payne case on Censor TV, where he still has a home. And he was letting it be known to anyone that would listen that he found the Innocence Project abhorrent. When this interview was recorded, the wrongful conviction movement had firmly hitched its wagon to the Black Lives Matter movement sweeping the country, pushing the idea that racism had caused the wrongful convictions of Julius Jones, Purvis Payne, and Rodney Reed, just to name a few. Devin and I talk about Payne's case in detail in this episode, and since this episode was recorded, both Payne and Julius Jones' convictions have been commuted from death to life. And not commuted because they were innocent or there was a miscarriage of justice, just because the Innocence Project, along with like-minded organizations like the ACLU, just because they threw enough money and might in the form of legal teams and public relations specialists to make it happen. And the killer supporters are still pushing to get these murderers out of prison. And it's no coincidence that currently the Indiana Black Lives Matter organization is being investigated for possible fraud by the state's attorney general, Todd Rokita. I think this episode is a good summation of my work on the wrongful conviction movement, made with someone who really gets it. And it's a very weird feeling to be one of a handful of people talking about what I consider to be a multi-billion dollar fraud sweeping our country. And it's an absolute relief and joy to speak to someone like Devin who gets it. And maybe a good analogy would be two people getting together and discussing the Naked Emperor. After this episode was released, I received a call from one of my former guests. He was concerned that Devin and I weren't taking into consideration the historical inequities in our legal system. But more than that, he was very upset that we were disparaging an entire movement, and especially the Innocence Project, that couldn't be as bad as we were painting it. Sure, Purvis Payne, who we called that guy, was incredibly, overwhelmingly, undeniably guilty, but the Innocence Project had to have gotten some factually innocent people out of prison. I told him I hadn't looked into every case, but everyone I had thoroughly researched turned out to be more of an obvious case of guilt than the last, but it's a little hard to say how many innocent cases that the Innocence Project represented that they would have for this not to be happening. I mean, it's a little like saying, I earned money with Bernie Madoff, so his Ponzi scheme wasn't as bad as the government made it out to be. And I asked my former guest if he had actually looked into any of the high-profile cases the Innocence Project is representing. I asked him if he had read the transcripts, and he said, that's what you do, you just read the transcripts. And I said, yes, and the appeals and pretty much anything you can get your hands on. And then he asked me, kind of took a different turn, and he asked me if my contrary take on these cases was a gimmick. I mean, something I had never considered. The idea that I would take an unpopular opinion just to stick out in a crowd and alienate 70% of the audience who are sure that I'm wrong because they've seen an activist documentary or Innocence Project PR media piece. I mean, he hung up shortly after, and his outrage mixed with what I felt was a little disappointment that I hadn't turned on my heels and changed my mind. And when I look back and remember that conversation, I don't remember feeling triumphant. I don't remember feeling like I had won. I just remember feeling sadness and strangely a little shame that I had let him down in some way. And I'm not sure what that's from, because all I can say is what I found to be the truth. But I think what he was really saying is that you had to be wrong. What you're pointing out is so absolutely horrible, so unbelievably horrifying and scary, it can't be happening. And I wish it weren't. I would gladly trade being wrong for this not to be happening. Unbelievably, I'm optimistic that one day this fraud will get larger exposure, and I believe some of it will collapse. Maybe I'm deluded, but I believe some of it will collapse. And when that day comes, I am expecting to take no pleasure in saying I told you so. I didn't have time to include some of my really great episodes with Based in Fact podcaster Lisa O'Brien about Rodney Reed, which I'm really proud of, as well as my episodes with Martin Pribe on Chicago's wrongful conviction movement, my episodes with Jane from the great organization, the National Organization of Victims of Juvenile Murderers, or any of my episodes with writer-journalist Gary Meese. There just was too many episodes to cover, which I guess is a good problem to have. I want to thank Tuesday Money, who is the voice of this podcast, who you can hear in the opening. And I want to especially thank Addie Abdo McDonald, who works behind the scenes to make this podcast great. Thank you also to my Patreon supporters who support my voice and my work and are enormously encouraging. I want to dedicate this episode to everyone who has listened with an open mind, who has pushed past their discomfort, to everyone who has been sure I'm wrong and checked the record out for themselves. Stay tuned for the next 200. A lot of fun and interesting stuff in the works.
So what made you want to start talking about the wrongful conviction movement?
Well, I've never heard it phrased like that. Wrongful conviction movement. Interesting. That's funny that there's a name. Yeah, I guess I'm on the outside, but I've independently discovered that there's a lot of shenanigans going on and it doesn't get covered. And so what you'll have is random people like me who, you know, I'm not from this field per se, but I do consider myself a morally grounded person. I mean, I am an Eagle Scout. I like to brag about to my audience. And I'm not seeing anyone else cover a lot of these cases. And I'm hearing, in fact, the opposite. I'm seeing the New York Times and very popular podcasts and very famous people stating things that are completely false and in a morally egregious way, effortlessly. And so it is shocking and appalling. And I feel like it's my duty to point out to whoever cares to listen that this is an outrage.
I agree.
I independently research these cases. And every time I go into one, I'm hoping I'm wrong. I'm hoping maybe they do have a case here. Like, why would they put their reputations behind something if it was so obviously one way? And I really do feel like I come into it with an open mind. And then I'm just shocked when the evidence just piles up and up and up. And I'm like, what am I watching here?
Do you hear that from your audience? Because I hear that a lot, that I think everybody's guilty. And I always try to explain that I'm always hoping that every case I look at is a case of a wrongful conviction. I just haven't found one of the cases that I've covered. But do you find that the people say to you, you think everybody's guilty? Or also they use the word biased a lot. Do you get that?
No, I think people realize that it's very uneventful to pick a case that is, I don't know, you got to be careful of confirmation bias. That is true. But that's not how I come to these cases. There are a ton of situations that it just doesn't interest me because it's so open and shut. If there's a gray zone, I'm just so irritated by how confident people are and they're so wrong. I mean, you could not be more wrong. And I feel like they get behind a case, a wrongful conviction case, because it's like this underdog story where they think, we got to help this person. You know, I'm going to be heroic here. And there's a great injustice being done. Meanwhile, ironically, they're taking part in a savage injustice, which is these victims are dead and forgotten half the time. And no one is representing them. Mm-hmm. You know, and their family is all traumatized. And there's no money and there's no movement behind supporting these victims. And if it's a district attorney, you know, these people are busy and they've moved on. There's 100 other cases they're working on. So who is going to stand up for those people? Mm-hmm. And instead, you get these narratives that are built, and it's these stories, and you can see the emotional notes that they're hitting, and it's so predictable, and it's repetitive. I can't believe a single person buys into it. But then you go on TikTok, and you go on social media, and it's like, how much research are these people putting into these cases?
What they ask me is, have you gone to the Innocence Project website? That's their research.
Oh, my God.
And that seems to be the press's research, too, on these cases.
And the Innocence Project, I don't think I'm being cynical here. I legitimately think that the word innocence is enough for people. That's their due diligence. They go, well, why am I trusting the Innocence Project? Well, have you not seen the title of their name?
I've had the same thought. I was like, are they just well branded?
Hi, Roberta. This is Addie. I just wanted to congratulate you on your 200th episode. Thank you for all the hard work you put on each episode and the podcast in general. And before you go, there are some people that have something to share with you. Take a listen.
Hi, Roberta. It's Shayna. Happy 200th episode. I've learned so much from your show, and I've had so much fun recording episodes with you. I'm so appreciative of your honesty, your integrity, and your willingness to ask the hard questions that no one else is asking, especially when the facts lead you to fight against the popular public opinion. I know I can always count on your show to stand up for victims and the justice they deserve, and I can't wait to hear what you do next.
It's always a pleasure and an honor to participate in this with you, and I enjoy listening to you very much.
Hi, Roberta. It's William Ramsey. Congratulations on your 200th episode. Keep up the great work. You're one of the best out there, and I look forward to listening to 200 more. Wishing you all the best, William.
Everybody in this country has turned their back on all this evidence, except people like you.
Hello, Roberta. It's Tuesday. I want to congratulate you on your 200th episode, and I want to thank you for all the times you allowed me to come on as a guest. Thank you and congratulations.
And thankfully, for those of us who care about the real story and want to get to the truth, we have the Roberta Glass True Crime Report.
Hello, Roberta. This is Isabel McFadden. Congratulations on the 200th episode. I would like to thank you for the wonderful interviews that we have had and for bringing the Madeline McCann case to the surface. We surely understand each other and we have such a great connection. And I am happy to call you a friend. And again, congratulations. Lots of love, Isabel.
With people that always speak the truth like you do, Roberta. Thank you. Thank you for your hard work.
Hi, Roberta. I want to congratulate you on your 200th episode. Since 2018, I've admired you as one of the few podcasters telling the whole story rather than just the parts that made the case of the week appear to be a wrongful conviction. When I was doing Clear and Convincing, I wished we could look and sound as professionally produced as your show is. You've set the bar high, and I hope I can meet it with Based in Fact. I can't wait to see what your next 200 episodes will be.
This place, I'd like it to be a place where people could express their opinions. They can back them up. So if you have an opinion, back it up. Why do you think that? Don't just say this stinks. Why? I think he's guilty. Why? Back it up. Back up your argument. I'd like the comment section to be a safe space to express your opinions, and I'd like my channel to be a place to come and hear maybe an opinion you don't agree with. Maybe you do. But I will be continuing to talk about uncomfortable subjects that people don't talk about, because I feel like I have to.